Administration and General Government is open. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 512.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Can we quickly do these committee bill introductions?
You want to do those first?
That would be terrific.
Okay. Close that public hearing. We'll open up a work session for the purpose of introducing bills for introduction.
Mr. Chair, we've got six concepts before us today. There's a brief summary on the memo that was distributed, and these came out, a lot of them just this afternoon, so I apologize if the committee members haven't had a chance to look at them. Do you want me to... What information can I provide, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, at this point, we're just introducing them.
That's right.
So, do you want to just do a motion and do
it? Let's do it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move LC 2662, dated 3-29-09, LC 2663, dated 2-23-09, LC 3051, dated 2-25-09, LC 3171, dated 2-24-09, LC 3411, dated 2-24-09, and LC 3620, dated 2-23-09, be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Cruz moves that LC 2662, dated 3-29, 2663, dated 2-23-09, 3051, dated 2-25-09, 3171, dated 2-24-09, 3411, dated 2-24-09, and LC 3620, dated 2-23-09, be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered. All right. I would like to also announce that we will not hear Senate Bill 70 today. If anyone's out there thinking about that bill, we're not going to get to that one. I would now like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 512. Dana, if you could give us a quick overview.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 512 replaces provisions of Senate Bill 1092 that this committee considered in 2008 and requires notice of certain offenses to school administrators, superintendent of school districts, or youth within the jurisdiction of a juvenile court. It specifies the contents of notice. It modifies the types of offenses for which notice would be required. And I know the Law Commission will walk us through this in more detail. We have amendments before the committee. Would you like me to speak to those, Mr. Chair?
Please.
The dash ones essentially add back in to the list of crimes that trigger notice sexual assault of an animal or animal abuse in any degree. The dash twos essentially leave intact what was passed in Senate Bill 1092 with regard to the crimes that trigger notice to schools.
Okay, and I would like to remind the committee today that the purpose here of this legislation is to rewrite a poorly drafted bill in the first place. And our job today is not so much to debate this law, which is already into effect, but to debate how it's executed. So, first up... Representative Buckley is here. Okay. Representative Buckley, would you like to testify on this? I'm so sorry I didn't see you there.
That's okay, Mr. Chair. Just walked in. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County. Thank you very much for your time and consideration. I thought I should drop by to extend at least an explanation, Mr. Chair, to the bill that you sent to our House Education Committee last February. You sent a fairly simple bill, and we did our best to complicate it. And what you have is the result before you. I came here today to...
You're the one.
So I am the one, Mr. Chair. Given the concern that many members, that several members of our committee had concerning the overall best interest of the child and how do you find that balance. This bill, like many others we wrestle with, have to do with the rights and the needs of the individual and the rights and needs of the community at large. And the original bill, I very much support the idea behind it. Teachers need to really have the information about their students. That's essential for them to make sure that they have safety in their classroom and the best use of their class time with the students that they are given responsibility to teach. Several members of our committee, as you know, had concerns about whether it could be a negative impact, unintended consequences on the student involved. We did ask the Law Commission to step in and try to examine that, and I do have to applaud the Law Commission for their willingness to spend a good deal of time during the interim to try to figure out where we could possibly take this, try to find that balance further. I did want to say, Mr. Chair, that I am in favor of the amendments to this bill to put back in the required notification on the list of crimes. Again, I believe that the teachers have proven themselves to be fully capable of handling confidential information in a way that does strike that balance in the best interest of the student and the best interest of their class as a whole and the best interest of the school as a whole. So I would encourage the committee to return to the original intent as much as possible while taking still the positive aspects that the Law Commission has brought forward in terms of the communication process from the legal system to the educational system. And with that, Mr. Chair, I just again thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Buckley? Thank you, sir. We'll let you get back down the hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. From the commission, Lane Shetterly, Mark Comstock, Wendy Johnson, Chrissy Nielsen from the Oregon Law Commission.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, attorney in practice in Dallas, here before you today as chair of the Oregon Law Commission. With me is Mark Comstock, who chaired the work group that developed Senate Bill 512 before you, and if it pleases the chair, we'll have Wendy Johnston and Christy come up after we're done, just
okay,
because it'll work better that way. I'll lead in with just a few comments about this and then turn it over to Mr. Comstock, who, as I said, did chair this task force. For background of the committee, the Oregon Law Commission was created back in 1997. It's been my pleasure to chair it since the Law Commission was established. It consists of the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, the deans of the three law schools of the state, two members appointed by the House, two members appointed by the Senate, a member appointed by the governor, and four members appointed by the Oregon Bar Association. It was to the Law Commission that the legislature referred Senate Bill 1092 in the February session specifically to study policies requiring a notice to schools of persons under 18 years of age. It was the notice issue that the legislature in particular asked the Law Commission to look at. The process by which the Law Commission does that and did in this case is to appoint a work group of interested members. In this case, that work group included representatives of district attorneys, school districts, teachers, juvenile court attorneys. Mark can go into more detail with that, but bottom line, it was a broad-based work group that made a recommendation to the Law Commission. So when a work group spends 6 or 7 months or 8 months developing a proposal, that proposal goes, before it comes to you, it goes to the full Law Commission and is debated and discussed by the full Law Commission. And then only after the Law Commission approves, with amendments in this case, as in many cases, do the bills actually come back to you. So that's the process. That's what's happened since February. Assignment to the Law Commission, assignment by the Law Commission to a work group to do the actual drafting and policy proposals that then come back to the full Law Commission, and then only after deliberation by the Law Commission back to the legislature. In this case, Senate Bill 512 comes to you in an unusual split vote of the commission, but the split vote of, I think, 10 members for, one member opposed, and one member, the Chief Justice, abstaining. Often he will abstain if there's a concern that a particular bill or statute might come before the court. But that was the vote on recommendation of the commission. I think that the principal issues in the draft before you have to do with changes that the Law Commission proposed to Senate Bill 1092 with regard to notice of pre-adjudication revocation situations. That is, where a juvenile has been charged with a crime, but only that. That is, has been charged with an offense that, if committed by an adult, would be a crime. I think that's the nomenclature in juvenile law. And the Law Commission came down with some recommendations that changes be made in notice in those particular cases of pre-adjudication. I won't go much farther into that. You'll get testimony from Mr. Comstock and I think also from Wendy and Christy. But my point is to, first of all, thank you for the confidence that the legislature has showed in the Law Commission by asking the commission to take up this very difficult issue that I think the legislature dealt with in a pretty short time frame last February. And we spent since February until last month when it was finally moved out of the commission to the legislature dealing with this. I'm pleased to present to you the product of that commission review, I think a very thoughtful review in Senate Bill 512. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions, but I think it may be of more interest to you to hear first from Mr. Comstock and perhaps Wendy and Christy as well.
I appreciate very much, Lane, and appreciate your service on this.
Thank you.
So why don't we do that, finish up with the panel before we go to take any questions.
Thank you, Chair Haas. Members of the committee, my name is Mark Comstock. I'm an attorney practicing here in Salem. About half of my practice for the last 25 years has been representing school districts in various matters, litigation, and advice. I am a member of the Oregon Law Commission, was appointed last fall, and I drew the task of chairing this work group. And as Lane has identified, the work group was made up of people that had specific expertise in the area. Representative Buckley was a member of that work group. He attended mostly by telephone, but he was certainly a member, and his input was very valuable. We had representatives of the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Department of Human Services, Oregon Youth Authority, Juvenile Rights Project, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. We had a sitting judge, Judge Horner from Polk County. Bob Jundelf from the Disabilities Rights Oregon Project. We had representatives of the Douglas County Juvenile Department and teachers, including the proponent of Senate Bill 1092, and also Superintendent Mary Alice Russell, Superintendent of McMinnville School District, was an active participant on the work group, and we valued her input. We also had Karen Stennard from the Lane County Juvenile Lawyers, John Van Driel, who I think will testify. He's a school psychologist with Salem-Keizer School District, Jeanette Williams, and Robin Wright, an attorney practicing in the juvenile area. We also had expertise of people that were advisors to the work group that were representing the judicial department, school districts, the Yamhill County Juvenile Department, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Oregon School Employees Association, and Oregon Education Association. This bill sought to do a couple of things, or this work group sought to do a couple of things. First, to clarify and make Senate Bill 1092 workable, both for district attorney's offices, juvenile departments, and for school districts. In that vein, it was shall we say, a spirited debate quite often. And I would want to address, and there is a Law Commission report that I believe is submitted to you, and I'm not going to get into all of that. I think the most controversial part of this is a reduction of the triggering events, the types of crimes that would cause notice to be given. And that's under Section 1, Section 7 of the bill. And It did what the recommendation is to reduce the number of, or the types of crimes to serious physical injury and also to exclude some of the types of crimes such as animal abuse and some sex offenses that are identified in the bill. The reasoning for that, and I know that there is, are comments that it's in a minority report of Mr. DiLorenzo, that it was a political compromise. Well, I submit it was not a political compromise. And the reason that those decisions were made is to specifically make it workable for the school districts so they're not inundated with notices. But there was a trade-off, and that trade-off was the provision for the sitting judge in the matter to order that notice be given to the school district in any crime that is charged. So that is a trade-off, so the shall we say, the decider on the ground or on the bench there can determine whether notice should be given in any particular case, not one of the automatic notice cases. So with that, I will turn it over to, well, so first I'd answer any questions that you might have, or I will turn it over to Wendy and Christy to go through the report and the provisions of the bill.
Why don't we do this? Why don't we, if you guys could stand by, and we'll have Wendy and Christy walk us through.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Oregon Law Commission. I think I'll go first and kind of give you an overview of the bill and give you sort of the goals and issues we faced, and then Christy Nielsen, our staff attorney, will go through section by section the bill. First, as Commissioner Shetterly pointed out, Section 16 of Senate Bill 1092 required the Law Commission to study the policies requiring notices to schools of persons who are under 18 who are youths. Youth means someone who's adjudicated, so we're talking about a juvenile delinquency. So when we looked at that charge of studying the notices to schools, first question was, well, what notices are required, and what did Senate Bill 1092 add? You'll see in your packet that the first thing we did was create a chart. It's Appendix 2 in your chart in your packet, and it's a lots of black lines and such. You'll see there are a whole lot of notices that were already required to be distributed to schools. Most of them were came after the 1998 Kip-Kinkle case. And so schools were already required to be receiving notices of Measure 11 chargings, Measure 11 sentencings, and Measure 11 releases. In addition to that, schools also were to be getting notices of probation lists. So these are juveniles who have been found guilty and are now on, or adjudicated is the proper term in juvenile court. They've been found adjudicated and now are on probation, or if they're not on probation, conditional release if they're under DHS's custody. So the schools were already getting a notice of that every month. And then there is also a notice to schools if a juvenile was transferred from one jurisdiction to another and they're still under OAA's legal custody. So those notices had been going for many years since after the Kinkle incident in 1988. So what Senate Bill 1092 did was add yet one more notice, and it's on pre-adjudication of the non-Measure 11 cases. And frankly, the list in 1092 is not precise on exactly which crimes would be noticed, but we know it's something more than the previous list of Measure 11 crimes. So I give you that background so that you can see that chart that we looked at that and saw, wow, these notices are inconsistent in terms of what's in the notice, when the notice is given, who gives the notice, and they're in different parts of the code and provide different liability provisions and such. And so a lot of what you see in Senate Bill 512 is cleaning up all of those notices at the same time. Now, Commissioners Comstock and Shetterly are correct that the the policy fight is really on this one, the list for these new pre-adjudication notices, but I want you to be aware that schools should be receiving and should have been receiving for many years these other notices. In doing this research, we learned that, guess what, a lot of the DAs and juvenile departments have not been following through on these provisions. And so one of the goals that we saw as our work is to educate and make sure that juvenile departments and schools are aware of these requirements. And so should Senate Bill 512 pass, the commission staff is ready to send a letter to the DA's Association as well as all the DA's offices and juvenile departments letting them know of these requirements. Part of the problem is that they're in the education code and not in the criminal code. And so it's a matter of just not knowing of some of these requirements. And so by making them all the same types of contents, we're hoping that it won't be as challenging for these notices to go out to schools as well. Let me explain the goals that as a commission we were looking to deal with. The first was just to make the notices work. Who would give them, when they would give them, and what would be in them so that it was useful to schools, that we weren't simply passing paper around. So one of our goals was to make sure the notices would work. Second would be to advance the policy goals that this legislature passed in the special session, which would be to assist schools with safety planning so they would have notices. So we wanted to, safety was our focus. Next was to allow for the differences in the counties and schools. We quickly realized that each county deals with juvenile delinquency cases differently. Some have juvenile departments taking different roles than others. Some have the DAs doing things that other counties, the juvenile departments do. Plus, you have such a different differences in schools, charter schools and public schools and private schools. And so we wanted to make sure that whatever system we have, that it covers all of those and it allows for those differences. For example, Salem-Keizer has a very advanced system for dealing with safety planning. We wanted to still allow for that, but to create a minimum threshold for across the state that would work. And so what you have is a minimum notice to schools that will help trigger and facilitate discussions with juvenile departments and the police and mental health and the schools. So it's a minimum notice that will encourage that discussion to begin. And finally, one of our goals was to address the legal and technical problems with Senate Bill 1092. For example, the word youth was used throughout the bill, and that doesn't work because of its meaning of a delinquent. A transfer student hasn't been adjudicated in Oregon, so that term just didn't work. There were some other technical problems that needed to be addressed. So those were our overall goals. So we met as a group several times. I think we're up to, was it seven? And so we heard a lot of the needs. Well, I think there were probably, I could probably summarize to say four main needs: to let schools do their job, which is safety planning, and determine how they were going to address safety. Second, to balance safety with privacy and protection of a student's constitutional as well as education rights. So that was probably the toughest need, which is to do that balancing between safety and privacy and protection. Next, to make it affordable. So keeping in mind all those goals and those needs, the work group came to a consensus product of Senate Bill 512. It was a consensus, but there were some objections to a couple of the provisions, but it was a consensus of the work group. And it was also, as Commissioner Shetterly mentioned, it was a 10-to-1-to-1 vote, the bill as it's introduced, Senate Bill 512. Bill then leaves you with really one big policy choice. I think everyone is pleased with the fixes that were made throughout the bill to make all the notices generally work and provide. Christy will go through the details of the new protections that are put in the bill. But there is one significant policy choice, and that's which crime should receive this pre-adjudication notice that is new. And as an aside, Oregon is quite different than other states on this. It's not common for pre-adjudication notices to go out. So with these pre-adjudication notices, it's which ones. The bill requires notice of four categories: the serious physical injury crimes, the sex crimes, weapons crimes, and destructive device crimes, and then allows a judge to require notice of any alleged crime, even if it's not within those four categories, if it's necessary for safety and security. This is known as an opt-in. Some of you may have heard last session there was talk of an opt-out, and I just want to explain that because it gets confusing of calling them opt-ins and opt-outs. The bill does not have an opt-out provision in it. There was discussion of putting it in 1092. There was discussion of putting it in 512. You'll see it not in there. And let me explain why. Because the list of crimes has been narrowed to these serious safety crimes, those advocates who were worried about juvenile rights and such are comfortable with this list going out without exception. And so you don't need to go to court and say, this notice does not need to go to this school because of this reason. It's a trade-off. I mean, there may be a case where folks would say this shouldn't go, but it's not in this anymore that you can go and ask for an opt-out. And that's important because it would basically have a mini-trial happening before the actual trial of, well, is this a safety concern? And so to do that, you're going to end up talking about the evidence in a case and such. And so it is a benefit to both the DAs, the Judicial Department, as well as defense attorneys to not have this mini-trial. So to all agree that these four categories, we will give notices, and we're not going to dispute that, perhaps is a plus for all. But once you start putting in more crimes, there's going to be more disputes on whether there is going to be a significant harm to the juvenile on having this non-adjudicated crime be provided notice to the schools. So that's the opt-out that's not in here, but I just wanted to clarify it for the record. And Christy Nielsen will go through the bill in detail, unless you have questions of me before I go farther.
Okay, Christy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christy Nielsen. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Law Commission. I've been given the task of taking you through the proposal of Senate Bill 512. And as you've heard, clearly a lot of the testimony that will be coming forward today, we anticipate will be on Section 1.7 of this proposal. But we wanted to highlight really the other 95% of this bill that we think there was a lot of good work that was done and there were some good changes that were made. So taking you through the bill kind of section by section, Section 1 just moves the definitions up to the front, makes it easier to read, streamlines the bill a little bit, and clarifies some of the definitions that had been placed in 1092, but this has a little bit better language. There was a lot of LC changes in this bill, you'll see through the entire product. Section 2 talks about the triggering event, so the point in the juvenile case in which the notice would be sent. So the first would be at the first appearance. That's the pre-adjudication notice, the 1092 notice, if you will. So when the petition is filed in the court.
Yeah. Yep. Stop. Just one little.
Two. Subsection. I'm sorry. It's section one, subsection two.
Page 2, line 12.
Okay. But while we stop, one of the problems with the original bill had the word youth was there, but I notice it's in the new bill in a different way. Can you explain that? Dynamic.
Because the major problem with the use of the word youth was it in the transfer student application, because a youth in Oregon law is a defined legal term of a person who is under the age of 18 and has been charged with an act that, if committed by an adult, would constitute a crime. And you wouldn't know if an out-of-state student is a youth for purposes of the Oregon revised statutes unless you know that they had been charged with a crime in a proceeding. So it needed to be left in for, in its reference to youth. There still are youth covered in some sections of this bill, just not the transfer.
So this is being used correctly in this context, is what you're saying?
We hope so, yes. So subsection 2, the first one then is the first appearance, that pre-adjudication notice. Second would be when a youth, after the petition is filed, admits to being within the jurisdiction of the court or is adjudicated, that's when they're found guilty. One major hole that we found in 1092 was that they get notice if there's a charge, they get notice if it's dismissed, but there's no notice if they're actually found guilty. And we thought that might be something that the schools would want to know about. So that was added in. Next would be if the charge is dismissed or if the youth is found to not be within the jurisdiction of the court. So if they're found not guilty or the charges are dismissed, then there's another notice coming out saying, here's what happened with the case. So now you'll find out when there's a charge, you'll find out what happens in either direction. So subsection 3 talks about who gives the notice. And this is basically the same as what was in 1092. The district attorney is presumed to be the one that would give the notice, but in some counties, as Wendy stated, there's other systems in place with juvenile departments what might handle these cases or such, so this allows for that to occur. And subsection 4 refers to the contents. The contents weren't by large changed very much. There was added in that the name and contact information of the attorney for the youth should be given if it's known so that they can be involved in this proceeding. One major change that was added was that conditions of release or terms of probation would be included in the notice, and felt that this would really, this goes back to the issue of we want not to just be giving a flood of paper to the schools, but it needs to have good information and the right information. So they don't necessarily want to have a piece of paper that says, you know, Johnny was charged with assault too. They want to know kind of what that means and if he's not supposed to have contact with someone or if he's not supposed to be with knives or something, then that would be something that the school should definitely know about for safety planning purposes. So that was added in. And subsection 5, turning to page 3, talks about some of the cautionary language that should be added into the notice. And there's different language that in substance should be included in each situation. So sub A would be when the petition is filed, it states that there's been a petition filed, the student may or may not become adjudicated, but just so that you can know for safety planning purposes, and you shouldn't discuss this matter with the student until the case is resolved and that you'll get further notice. Then the second one in B is when they're found within the jurisdiction, basically says there's been a finding made, they are within the jurisdiction, so they've been found guilty, but you know, there may still be pending proceedings, it could still be dismissed or so forth, so you shouldn't discuss it with the student, but this is just giving you more information. And then in C is the notice that's given out when there's a dismissal. And this also requires that the school should destroy any information that's relating to the original notice so that incorrect information doesn't follow a student throughout their educational career by having this notice in their educational records. So subsection 6 talks about when and the timelines of when these notices should be given. And this just ties it back to how we added in that there's been a time for admission or adjudication. So it's still within 15 days of these events occurring, which was the timeline that was placed in during on 1092. Subsection 7 is the section that is, you know, the center of most of the debate. It's the acts that trigger the notice of when these notices should be sent to school. I think Wendy did a pretty good job of explaining it. It's 4 presumptive categories of when these notices will automatically be giving out in every case where the charge fits into one of those categories. And then if there's, you know, some circumstance that the judge feels that it's necessary that notice should be given, notwithstanding those 4 listed categories above, then notice should also be given. And there's no means for having a notice to not be sent, no opt-out. Something that's really important in this, which is in subsection 7, little a, big A, is that the language was changed from harm or threatened harm to serious physical injury. Harm or threatened harm, when it was put in and once 1092 went into effect, this is the only instance in the entire Oregon Revised Statutes where this language is used. So this is not a legal term. This is not a district attorney. This is not jargon that they use. It's just a, you know, a descriptive, and it's harm or threatened harm. We heard from different juvenile departments and district attorneys who said this could be anything from a shoplifting. This could be, you know, what it harms another person. And then some said, no, we read it more narrowly to be physical injury. We felt that the intent was to go at physical injury because it's a safety planning issue, so that's why that language was changed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, threat of harm is a common term in used in DHS when it comes to removing a child from the home. Threat of harm is one of the standards they use. So it's a commonly known standard in one place. Why doesn't that transfer?
Senator Cruz, Senator Haas, it's not a term that is used in the criminal code, and as the DAs and the juvenile departments are the ones that are to be administering this, this is not a term that they have, that they can wrap their heads around.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, except the DAs are involved in cases where they remove kids from the home, so I'm kind of questioning why, if they're wearing the hat of, on one hand, I mean, you know, lawyers are involved. I'm very familiar with the whole foster care mess we have in the state, and lawyer, the DA's office is involved, the Attorney General's office is involved, the judges are involved, you know, and so, and this is a very common term there. I'm just wondering why if it's common for lawyers in one setting, why can it not be common for lawyers in another?
That was a rhetorical question.
Well, no, it's not necessarily a rhetorical question. It's, you know, a lawyer can say, well, in this context, I have no idea what this means, but over here I know exactly what it means. And I guess it's just confusion. Not being a lawyer, I don't understand some of these intricacies. And, Mr. Chair, before he starts, you know, he used to have a very dark mustache. I don't know what happened to that. But
Mr. Senator Cruz, Mr. Chair, that was when you had more hair.
That's true.
Touché. Or toupee.
If I can just wander into that line of questioning. Senator Cruz, as you know, the DHS statutes are very particular, and harm in those contexts refer to harm to a child. And there's a fairly well-understood body of law that addresses risk of harm to a child for the purpose of foster care and dependency care. This is harm in the context, as Christy said, harm in the context of the criminal code. These are, because you are receiving notice of charges filed involving harm or threatened harm by the child to another person. So it's a completely different context. And the context of the DHS statutes really doesn't apply here and wouldn't help the DAs in understanding what harm or threatened harm means in the context of conduct committed by a child against another party. So for these purposes, that other meaning really doesn't help clarify for either the DAs or the juvenile departments what harm or threatened harm means.
Okay, just help me a little more here, Lane. Because in DHS, it's potential harm to a child. This is potential harm from a child. What's the difference? It's still a person against a person.
Yeah. Again, Senator Cruz and Mr. Chair, it's important in that the context of this all occurs within the criminal code. Nothing will be noticed to a school district unless it constitutes a crime within the criminal code. And so working within the parameters of that criminal code, you don't have an equivalent standard of harm or threatened harm that means anything with regard to those criminal statutes. The DHS statutes are much more general, much more generic, and much more malleable in terms of what they mean by the way of risk to a child. But where we're talking here about an act committed by a child, it really helps to have the terminology sync up with the criminal code, so the DAs and the juvenile departments who are dealing with these, which are essentially criminal charges, have a context within which to place them.
Okay. If I could just one more. Okay, what if this just said involves physical injury rather than serious? I mean, is serious how much higher of a bar is that than just a threat of injury? Because that does go within the criminal code.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz. You could do that. Physical injury, if you did, and this is just a place where the work group and the commission drew the line, if you did that, then that would encompass all assault crimes, all assault charges. Where the work group drew the line was serious physical injury, which would not require notice categorically in all assault 4 cases. Those are your lowest level of assault crimes. It's a misdemeanor crime. And because of that, you probably have a higher, much higher volume of assault 4 cases than you do of assault 3, 2, and 1. 3, 2, and 1 are your serious physical injury crimes. So the work group drew the line that in terms of really getting at safety, it's those crimes that threaten the serious physical injury that are the ones that in all cases, categorically, school districts should get notice of without exception. And that's the way they're dealt with in Senate Bill 512. Having said that, it doesn't exclude notice in assault 4 cases, because again, a judge could look at this and say, hey, this is just an assault 4, but you know, it easily could have been an assault 3. I think there's more risk here than the charge really indicates, and I'm going to require notice in this assault 4 case. The bill allows that to happen. It just doesn't require categorically notice to go out every time there in pre-adjudication. Again, this is before adjudication. It doesn't require notice to go out in every assault 4 case to the district. In part, there's a sense here, too, that we're trying to not to overwhelm districts, especially larger districts in larger communities, with a lot of paperwork that they're going to have to deal and plan with. And so I think the thinking of the work group and the commission was to focus on those categorical offenses that are the more serious while allowing the judges, if the circumstances warrant, to say, even though it's not categorically required, I think there's enough of a threat here that we're going to require that notice be given. So that was just the balancing in terms of trying to make this workable, still address safety, but by the same token give judges the discretion to make the call, even in cases that aren't categorically required for notice. Once, of course, you get to adjudication, notice goes out in all cases. This is just pre-adjudication.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Shettle, please continue.
So moving on to Section 2 of the bill, starting on page 4, again, there's some cleanup of definitions in this section, and these would be including who gets the notice from the superintendent, so the definition of school personnel. And actually, we noticed, I believe, in 1092 that teachers were not categorically included, so this kind of fixed a bit of a gap that was in there. Also, moving on to subsection 2, it just gets to the mandatory requirement that if they receive notice and that there has been a dismissal of the case or a finding of non-adjudication, that the information has to be destroyed and taken out. So it ties it into the statement that they have to do that, which is included in that notice. Subsection 3 is the transfer student section, and again, you don't see a lot of changes here, but really the big points that we made were we removed the term youth, as stated before, because it was incorrectly used in this context, and also it's now tied to a specific point, so it's this information is requested of the transfer student when the education records are requested. We felt that tying it to something that they already have to do will make it easier for the school districts to handle this process. So they're calling or faxing or whatever to request the information already, and then while they're doing this, they're making the inquiry about the student's behavioral issues. Subsection 4 says that the schools can adopt policies and procedures relating to how they handle these notices. The work group felt pretty wholeheartedly and reflecting some of what Representative Buckley stated, that school districts should be trusted with this information. They can handle it in ways that they feel appropriate. So we didn't feel it would be necessary to put in strict protocols about where this needed to go in the file and how they need to keep it in a separate, you know, envelope or whatever. We just felt that the school districts could handle this and set up protocols appropriately. And a lot of this is also cleanup onto the remainder of page 5. Subsection 5A or subsection 5 just discusses who can receive the information. It says it's confidential, but these are the people that can be discussing, or they can share the information with these specific people. It adds the attorney for the person who's subject to the notice or the transfer student so that they can get this information as well. At the bottom of page 5, subsection 6 refers to students who may have disabilities or individual education plans. It just says that any educational decisions that are made based on these notices can't interfere with their individual education plans that are already in place. So that would be it for what is changed about what's in Senate Bill 1092. The remaining sections are the sections that Wendy spoke of that were the subject of the chart, these other notices that were already being given. Since the Law Commission was charged with looking at these other notices that were already in place and trying to make that whole system work a little bit better, one of the things that we wanted to do was to try to streamline some of the information and make some of the information the same on all the notices so schools know what they're getting. And also, just to make sure that, again, it's the right information, that it's helpful information, and it's not just a piece of paper that the schools are getting. So section 3 on page 6 is the Measure 11 or the waiver notice that's given at the time of charging. And that adds in some more information, including conditions of release in terms of probation, which would definitely be important, especially in these more serious crimes as these kids are out of detention. Section 4 would be Measure 11 or waiver crimes at the time of sentencing. So again, it gives terms of the sentencing and conditions that have to be met by the student. Section 5 is when a youth is released from OYA custody, and it includes basically the same information, but it's just tying it back to the other thing and adding more information to the notice so that the conditions of release are given to the schools so that they know what has to be complied with. Section 6 on the bottom of page 7 discusses confidentiality. Section 7 is the probation list that's sent out monthly. The only change in there is from definition cleanup that LC included. Section 8 is the notice that's given out when kids who are within OYA custody are changing school districts, and so the new school district needs to get the information about these kids. And there's additional information that's added in that one. The name of the youth offender wasn't even included in that original notice, and we thought that might be something that would be helpful. So, again, it was just kind of a lot of stuff in these sections. And
some of this makes me want to crawl under the table.
Making them better. And Section 9 is, again, where someone is released from OYA custody, the information that's given out, and it's just streamlined. And finally, Section 10 is the emergency clause, because this does amend some things that currently went into effect back in January 1st. So it will go into effect right away. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you for walking us through that. Questions? The commission, the panel.
I have a question.
Senator Bonavici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that the chair said that we're not here to revisit the bill that was passed in 2008, but I wasn't on the committee that considered that bill. I remember some discussions about it, but I think it would be helpful, at least to me, in putting all of this in context, if you talk just briefly about where the gaps were and what kinds of things teachers are not finding out about. And I'll give you an example. I unfortunately have, Mr. I'm going to get in trouble from the chair, but I have this on, and I just got an email from the Washington County Sheriff that on Friday, a 13-year-old male juvenile was arrested at his home in Banks regarding a bomb threat at the Banks Junior High School. So I get this alert from the Washington County Sheriff. And so I figure that since I got it, most people in the community probably know about it, and the kids all have it on their Facebook now, so everybody at the school knows about it. So where were the gaps that led to this, if there's so much information that's out there already about what's happening? What's the context in which we should be looking at this? What are the holes we're trying to fill?
Chair Hess, Senator Bonamici, I think you're correct that a lot of this information is already flowing pretty freely, but it's the smaller crimes that are serious and violent, but that aren't on the news, or it's more the districts that are so large that they're not paying attention to which kids are in their particularly their school, or happened in a different jurisdiction, and now it's the crime happened in a different jurisdiction, and now it's the kids back at school. Many districts are doing a great job of communicating with their juvenile departments and their DA's office and their police, and they have. We learned that many sheriffs and police officers actually call the superintendent on a regular basis and their principal, and they know exactly which kids were picked up over the weekend, but other districts have no information. And so this is a perception that teachers particularly and staff are not knowing what's going on. So maybe the superintendent will know, but this bill, 1092, required the school superintendent or another person, depending on the circumstance, within 48 hours to pass it on. So I think that was another piece of it that we haven't talked a lot about, but it's not just notice to the school, but a requirement to pass it on. And so the crimes that you have to pass on are kind of what we're, the policy choice that you used, that it's really before you today, but I think the impetus for Senate Bill 1092 was a minimum notice to schools and then plus a requirement to pass it on.
Just a brief follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you said some of the superintendents actually call and get the information. So is this information that we're talking about all public record?
Chair Hess, Senator Bonamici, some of it is that a petition has been filed is not considered confidential, and it's all dictated by the juvenile code. The victim obviously is confidential, and many of the details are confidential, but the fact that something has been charged is not confidential.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? And I think we'll have some people testify, and Senator Bonamici, to address that question specifically coming up later. Thank you, Commissioner. Chair, sir. John DiLorenzo and Doug Harkleroad.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I am here today in my capacity as a member of the Oregon Law Commission. I am going on my second term as a member of the commission. I am the lone dissenter with respect to the commission's recommendation that this bill be favorably considered by your committee, but I don't view myself necessarily as a fly in the ointment, rather as a member of the loyal opposition, in that I only wish to improve this bill. I voted against the bill at the commission level for the purpose of having the opportunity to file the minority report that you have with you, and I do not take issue with most of the good work that has gone into the preparation of this bill. Rather, I am focused, my objections are focused on what appears at page 3, lines 29 through 42 of the printed bill, and that's where I am concentrating. I first come from the perspective that that Senate Bill 512 approved by the Commission assumes that school personnel will be circumspect in the way they treat the information that is provided to them by balancing the potential ramification of the notices of the charges on a student versus the need to protect other students and the benefit that comes from that information. Assuming that this is the case, at one level it makes no sense to me to therefore limit the amount of information which the teachers and school administration are provided, since it is assumed that they will treat it all with equal sensitivity anyway. I do take great issue with the Commission's elimination of categories of conduct by the affected juveniles, which, if charged, should be worthy of notice to school officials. You will notice at page 3, lines 29 through 42 of the bill, that although current law triggers a notice if a juvenile is accused by the district attorney of conduct that, if committed by an adult, would constitute a crime involving harm or threaten harm to another person, the Commission has changed this to conduct that, if committed by an adult, would constitute a crime that involves serious physical injury or threatens serious physical injury to another person. Mr. Harkelrode, who is with me, the former district attorney for Lane County, will comment on that and what the ramifications of that change happens to be. But in so doing, the Commission has narrowed the type of conduct that would warrant notice to school officials. In addition, current law triggers a notice if a juvenile is accused of an offense which, if committed by an adult, would constitute certain crimes that include misdemeanor or felony sex offenses. The Commission's recommendation has narrowed the scope of the reportable conduct to only those sex offenses that would constitute a felony. I object to that narrowing. In addition, the current law requires a notice if a district attorney accuses a juvenile of conduct which, if committed by an adult, would constitute a crime involving sexual assault of an animal or animal abuse in any degree. The Commission recommendation has eliminated this as a category of conduct from the notice provisions. And finally, current law requires a notice if the juvenile is accused by the district attorney of conduct which, if committed by an adult, would constitute a crime involving an offense for which the manufacture or delivery of alcohol or a controlled substance is an element of the crime. The Commission has also eliminated this category from the notice provisions. This bill and the Dash 2 amendments, which I am requesting you favorably consider, only concerns a very small portion of proceedings which are initiated by district attorneys by petition. I understand that the vast majority of these are conciliation agreements, so these are the most serious potential offenses. These are not minor schoolyard brawls. These involve conduct which is serious enough to warrant a district attorney actually commencing a proceeding. As a parent of a child who may be attending public school, it is my view that if a juvenile engages in conduct which is serious enough for a district attorney to commence a proceeding, like selling drugs next door off campus or chopping heads off of animals, I would like the teachers and school personnel to know about it so that they can first and foremost protect the other children in the class, and secondly, possibly be of assistance to the child that is undergoing troubles. I think some mention has been made of the trade-off, the opt-in program, whereby a judge can decide that, notwithstanding the lack of notice provisions, it might be a good idea to provide a notice. I think there should be an opt-out if there's an opt-anything. Frankly, I do not want to rely on judges to decide whether school personnel have notices. If we are going to take the position that school personnel are entitled to know these things, we should not limit the amount of information teachers and school personnel are provided with. We should give them the whole story. The Dash 2 amendments restore all of the italicized provisions in that series and eliminate all the bold. In other words, they just bring back the current law as it relates to the number of crimes that are reportable. I want to conclude at this point and only say that I appreciate very much the support of former District Attorney Harkelrode, who's with me today. Also, District Attorney Josh Marquis has submitted a letter in support of our Dash 2 amendments. And I also want to extend a word of appreciation to Representative Buckley, who I understand also supports bringing back this list of crimes. Thank you very much. I appreciate your patience, and we'll be available for any questions if you have any.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Mr. Harkelrode.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney. I've spent 34 years as a prosecutor, 23-plus of those as the Lane County District Attorney, virtually a career. I'm currently a lawyer in private practice, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance in that capacity. I want to tell you a brief story. I was driving down the freeway headed into the Eugene area when I got a call from my wife, who teaches nursing at our local hospital and was there early in the morning. And she said, Doug, I want you to know that all of the trauma teams have been activated and they're bringing in multiple gunshot victims from Thurston High School. That was referenced in the Kip Tinkle case earlier. I immediately dropped in behind a police officer who was going very fast, called his dispatcher and said, this Aerostar van behind you is the DA in Lane County, and I'm following you in. I got there for triage. It was a mess. As you can imagine, there were 26 wounded, 2 dead children, and we later found out that the parents were killed as well. I tell that story because we're not safe at school as we were 40 or 50 years ago. In Eugene, we have what we call resource officers. Those are policemen with guns on campus. We're not as safe as we used to be. We need to do what we can to be safe. Now, our research, and I want to tell you this only because animal abuse is mentioned in here, our research shows that Kip Tinkle did not abuse animals. And that's been widely reported incorrectly in the press, and I just didn't want you to walk away thinking that and that I was implicating that at all. I'm not. My point is, we're not safe at school like we were a long time ago. All right. So, if we're not safe, then what should we do? Well, you passed a bill in the special session that had some flaws in it, workability issues, and the Oregon Law Commission has fixed that. They said 95% of it, and 95% of it, Mr. DiLorenzo and I have no objection to at all. However, in the area where we're reducing the number of crimes that teachers are told about, we object to that. I support, and the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance supports, the Dash 2 amendments. So let me take a very quick walk through that. Serious physical injury instead of harm or threatened harm. By the way, as a prosecutor for a long time, I can work just fine with harm or threatened harm. I look at the statute and say, is that harm or threatened harm? Strangulation. It's a misdemeanor. There's no serious physical injury involved in that. But it's putting your hands and blocking the airway and choking. I tried one of those cases last August. The victim was an adult, but there was no serious physical injury. That sounds like a serious crime in terms of telling a teacher that that happened. And that's certainly harm or threatened harm. If I got up, which I do not intend to do, Chair Haas, and came over there and I hit you in the face and broke your nose and gave you a black eye, that would not be serious physical injury under Oregon's law. The standard is very, very high. Now, if I displaced your nose and you had to have surgery on it, then maybe we're getting to serious physical injury. The standard is way too high in this bill for notification. Harm or threatened harm works just fine. Sexual assault of an animal or animal abuse in any degree is taken out. I'd suggest you leave that in. There is significant correlation between that kind of behavior and future violence, and Mr. Marquis has referenced a study in the letter that you've got there. Enough said about that. It seems easy to me. Sex offenses. This would limit to felony sex offenses. There are a lot of serious non-felony sex offenses. And wouldn't it be better if the teacher knew more rather than less? That seems real easy to me. The teacher should know more rather than less. And the possession or manufacture of drugs. If somebody's been charged with possession or manufacture or delivery of drugs, manufacturers growing marijuana, manufacturing meth, or delivery as sales. Think of it as a sale. Wouldn't that be a good idea to know that the teacher has been charged with that, or that the student has been charged with that, and the teacher should know that? Doesn't mean necessarily they're going to be convicted, although the conviction rates are very high, or the admission rates are very high in the juvenile department as well as in the adult system. Mr. De Lorenzo mentioned petitions. District attorneys file the petitions. In Lane County, we had about 3,000-4,000 referrals to the juvenile department every year. And our office would file 300 petitions. Why? Because we let the juvenile department deal with the minor things. Now other DA's office do it a little differently, and they broaden it out some and file more petitions rather than less. But my point is if the DA is going to take the time to file a petition, it's a fairly serious event. And lots of the minor things are done on what we call formal accountability agreements, specifically set up in the law. And it's a deal between the youth, hopefully the parents, and the juvenile department to do a few things, or maybe a lot of things, so that they don't, so that they get back on the right track. Way over here, formal accountability agreements. We're not even talking about those in this bill. It's only the petitions, and that's a significant difference. Now, in terms of the public information, what this bill does is it requires notice of what is already public information to the school district. It just gets it to them about an individual. And that's in Oregon Revised Statutes 419A.255, sub 5, sub D. And basically what that says is that notwithstanding any other provision of the law, the following are not confidential and not exempt from disclosure. So you can walk into a juvenile department and you can get this information. And what can you get? You can get the act alleged in the petition that if committed by an adult would constitute a crime. That's the pleading. That's the charge. The defendant did unlawfully and knowingly and then commit strangulation or commit assault for or whatever you have. So it's already public information under the juvenile code. So we're not asking to give teachers, and this bill doesn't give teachers anything special that they couldn't get by walking in the door and asking for it at the juvenile department. The last thing I want to mention here is that there's really a whole another reason for giving this information to teachers. You know, teachers are wonderful people by and large. They're doing great work for us. And although I know this bill is dealing with safety, if a teacher knows information, information is power. It's power to do something good for the child. And so if they know about the charge that's pending on the child, they may be better able to help that child. And we shouldn't lose sight of that, as well as the safety concerns for the school. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz?
Yeah. Thank you. As far as the change of harm or threat of harm, if that is an issue with some, what if we just removed the word serious and we're talking involves physical injury or threatened physical injury?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, that could work. The only problem is that would be a piecemeal approach to the need, which is to reinstate an entire list of crimes. The advantage to the Dash 2 amendments is that it will just add them all back, including...
Mr. Chair, I'm not arguing the other points. I'm arguing that one specific line there. I'm going to grant the rest of them, but that one specific line, if indeed that is problematic, I personally think assault of an animal or it should be included. I think felony should be removed. You know, all that. But I'm just talking about that one line. Does that really change a whole lot if it makes it more palatable?
Let me defer to Mr. Herkelrode.
I believe that harm or threatened harm is a little broader than is removing the word serious and just having it be physical injury. Physical injury is impairment of physical condition or substantial pain under the law, or the threat of that. And for the most part, that's going to cover most of it. But there might be a time when harm or threatened harm is a little bit broader. That's all I'm saying. If you had to choose between serious and just physical injury, I choose physical injury every time.
I think, for my money, I don't disagree with a lot of what you said, but in making the workplace safer in schools for teachers and other people, other students, I want to be cognizant of burying the system in paperwork and DAs and the bureaucracy. Now, you did this for a while as a prosecutor. How do you see this if we, you know, logistically, how do you see this playing out? Would there be a lot more work? Will the prosecutors have to hire more people just to look at this? Where do you see some, obviously more paperwork, but we want to be careful with that. Can you speak to that?
Yes, I can speak to that, Chair Haas and members of the committee. Actually, I talked to Lynn Schroeder, who's the number two person at the Juvenile Department in Lane County, about that issue here the other day, and she said they were worried about it. I talked to the lawyer that I hired a long time ago, named Mark Haight, who was the prosecutor at the Juvenile Department in Lane County, and he basically said, we got to have the juvenile folks do this. Here's how I believe this works. When the case comes in to the juvenile department, it's basically police reports from some officer who's done an investigation. That's almost always the way they come in. And the reports are read either by a prosecutor or by a juvenile intake officer, depending on the county, and they decide what should happen. If they decide that it should go in an informal way, that formal accountability agreement, then there's no notice issues at all, because it's only if a petition is filed. If they decide to file a petition, they draft the petition right there, and from my point of view, they draft the notice right there at the same time. And this is all computerized, at least in the larger jurisdictions, so it's not a big deal to put out another form right at the same time, and that's what I discussed with Lynn Schroeder from Lane County. I don't see burying anybody in paperwork doing this. I suspect that we could figure out a way to do it electronically. And in Lane County, it's going to be 300 cases, 400 cases a year. Other places, maybe more. Certainly smaller jurisdictions, a lot less.
Okay. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there any discussion about what steps would need to be taken to have the court make a determination under that new subparagraph B on page 3? And this is a two-part question. And is there any of the italicized language that you want to put back in that wouldn't be within that language in B?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, unfortunately, I was not a member of that particular work group, and so I was not privy to that discussion. Every member of the Oregon Law Commission is not a member of every work group, but the entire commission, after hearing a presentation from the work group, has to vote to approve the matter before it comes here to the legislature. And I heard the entire presentation, and the areas that I am focusing on are the areas that I personally could not countenance. That question is probably best addressed by Wendy, who, if you wish, could be called upon at some point to respond.
Chair Oz, may I respond as well? Yeah, members of the committee. That's a discretionary thing with the judge. That's generally a good thing. Just remember, you were concerned about the workload and the flow. When it's discretionary, that means we're going to fight about it. So we're going to have a hearing, potentially, to decide whether or not this is an appropriate one to send a notice out, with the person representing the youth saying, don't do it, and the prosecutor saying, please do it. So there's a risk there that you will have some litigation rather than just an automatic notice going out. I can't tell you just exactly how that'll play out, because it would be new and different there.
Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this involves the lone dissenter, I call you that, or our district attorney. So it might be both of you, but and I don't want to belabor this, but I'm trying to work this on my mind as you talk about the harm, threatened harm. You know, we've had Mr. Shetterly and others say these words are not art in the criminal code, and so if it were to stay that way, I guess my first question would be, since we have already heard that whether it's lack of education, whether DAs aren't even making the notices now, even under the bill as they currently have it, are we more likely to have not to notice schools because they're going to look at it and say, under my criminal code, there is no process for evaluating this, so I'm not going to notice at all, and continue the practice that has already begun and actually work against the intent?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, I prefer the loyal opposition, actually.
Okay.
I think Mr. Harkleroad can answer your question for you.
District attorneys try to follow the law, and I think if they read that harm and threatened harm, they're not going to say that this doesn't apply to anything, so we're not sending out notices. Now, if they didn't know about the law, that's one thing, and I heard there's going to be an education effort. I think that's a great idea. But frankly, it's pretty easy to take all the statutes, look at them, and say, is strangulation threatening harm or not threatening harm? Is menacing threatening harm or not threatening harm? And you can go through them one at a time, and you can figure that out pretty easily. And the experienced prosecutors wouldn't have very much difference on that. So I think it would work just fine. If you're uncomfortable with that, then I'd urge you to go with the physical injury rather than serious physical injury.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, gentlemen, appreciate your work.
Thank you very much.
Lori Wimmer and Ginger Redlinger.
I brought a friend. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing the Oregon Education Association, its 48,000 members. Thank you very much for this hearing today on Senate Bill 512. OEA brought Senate Bill 1092, thanks to the leadership of the chair and another senator, in February 08, as you've heard, with the express purpose of providing a safer school setting for staff and students, and also educational opportunity, even with respect to the student who's been charged with a crime that could be characterized as violence-related. That bill went through any number of iterations, even though it was a very compressed period of time for that supplemental session. We tried to bring all parties to the table in a very large work group. We made lots of compromises, and while I think that the rushed nature of that short session meant that there were some technicalities that needed to be cleaned up, overall, we felt that the bill accomplished the main goal of our organization, which was to ensure that safe and educationally opportune place for all students. We participated on the work group of the Oregon Law Commission with respect to the policy look at this law, this new law, which just took effect on January 1st. And it worked, I think, for about 3 or 4 months this fall and early winter under the able leadership of Mr. Comstock, I might add, who helped a lot with a lot of the compromises that were then made again. As we had in the February session, we feel that a lot more of those difficult issues to grapple with were resolved in that process. So we're here today to support the vast majority, as those who've come before me have said, of Senate Bill 512. but we, too, are deeply concerned about the removal of the four different areas of the crimes that you've heard mentioned today. I'd like to remind you of a couple of main facts about the new law. One is that the information that we're seeking is not generally considered confidential, and our need for it has nothing to do with further punishing or stigmatizing children. In fact, our members regularly know about the economic, psychological, personal, medical, and academically sensitive information of our students and our child abuse, mandatory child abuse reporters, and know about all kinds of HIPAA and FERPA sensitive information on these students. So they're regularly dealing in a confidential and sensitive way with these students. We do, however, feel that the broader range of crimes, which was whittled down significantly from our initial take at this legislation, are important for a variety of reasons. Let's start with the assault four issue. The changing of the language means basically all assault fours are gone. When I sat in the work group, because I'm not an attorney, I wasn't aware that, for example, and this was from a Multnomah County DA who told me this, if a student shatters the eye socket of another student, that's an assault four. If a student breaks the jaw of another student, that's an assault four. If a student shoots another student and it misses the vital organs so that there is no life-threatening emergency, that is an assault four. We're not talking about playground bullies. And it only rises to an assault three, by the way, if two or more parties are involved in the assault. So the assault three is not a more dangerous crime. It's simply more people involved as perpetrators. So I caution you to think about these changes with regard to that kind of difficulty. I, as a parent, would want to know if my education personnel were made aware to protect the environment of the school my daughter attends if a student who has shot another student is back in the school district. And given the budget cuts that we are currently experiencing in our juvenile facilities and youth corrections programs and probably will in 09-11, I think these notice requirements are even more essential than they ever have been. Take secondly the issue of the sex crimes. The main issue was incest in our conversations. The reason that some of the folks wanted that taken out was that they felt that the victim would be disclosed if a school district were noticed, because presumably all the kids in the school would be attending the same school district, and therefore a victim's privacy rights would be violated. Well, there ought to be another way to deal with that and still have that in there, given that those who commit that particular crime may not be simply a threat to family members. They may be a rape threat for other folks as well. And so we would want all sex crimes mentioned, and perhaps then the notice requirement could say only that has been charged with conduct of a sexual nature, so that it doesn't in any way implicate the victim. The alcohol and drug manufacture and delivery was whittled down from a much larger list, and we would certainly be okay with whittling it further to the manufacture and delivery of drugs only, particularly drugs involving a minor. And we have, by the way, for all of these, including restoration of the animal abuse piece, a compromised version of amendments to this bill in Legislative Council. They weren't able to have them for you by today because of their deadline for having bills on the Secretary's desk. But I'm sure we'll have them later this week. We're trying to be as cooperative as possible in making sure this is a workable law. But we do think that if we had our druthers, we would either have the dash twos Mr. DiLorenzo outlined for you, or this compromised version, or in the alternative, no bill at all, rather than 512 as drafted. Absent the demonstration of a problem, we don't think that we should substantially narrow these laws. I will tell you that I just heard that the issue was large districts being inundated or overwhelmed. Well, I've spoken with the Portland Public Schools and the Multnomah County DA. So far, they've gotten 18 notices, and apparently it's working well. Plus, they got one notice of a dismissal. So that's not exactly inundation in about 2 months' time. And that's the largest school district in the state. So I think that we're okay. It's a we wouldn't want to have a solution in search of a problem with respect to that section, and so we're asking for you to either restore it entirely or restore it in major substance, which we will bring in those amendments in the future. Now, with that, I'd like to turn it over to the member of OEA who brought this first to our attention as staff and who has a story to tell both about the history and some other thoughts about the legislation, and she's brought someone else with her that she will also introduce then, and he will also testify. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Chair Haas, committee. My name is Ginger Redlinger. I'm an OEA member, a teacher on special assignment at Oregon City High School, where I serve 2,300 students on a day-to-day basis for up to 12 hours a day. And my job is to help protect the safety, security, and ensure the academic growth and well-being of all the students at the school. I brought with me Brad Shree, and he is the administrator responsible for school safety at Oregon City High School and was the person that inspired me to bring this to the OEA Rep Assembly to see what we could do. And I'll give you a little information about that, especially for the Senator Bonamici, who is new to the committee, to help her understand the context of how we came to have 1092. I was in class one day and planned a physical science lab determining the amount of calories in a peanut by using a Bunsen burner to heat it up. And, you know, and a student that was assigned to a lab station with another student raised his hand, and I went over to the lab station. He says, "I can't do this lab." And I said, "Well, that's unusual. What do you mean? Do you need help? Do you need some background?" And he was new to my classroom. He'd only been there for a couple of days. And he said, "No, I'm on parole for arson. I'm not allowed to do this lab." And I was embarrassed for him. He was comfortable saying it, but he didn't realize that he had shared it in front of the whole class. So immediately the class responded to, "Whoa, you were in jail, cool," you know, kind of thing. And some of the other kids started backing away from him. And I felt awful, because he had put himself in a situation, and I was put in a situation, and the school was put in a situation that I was not allowed to have that information. This is prior to 1092. So I went to Mr. Shreve, who was my supervisor at the time, and said, "All right, Brad, the student shared this information with me. Why didn't anyone tell me?" And he said, "Because it's not legal for me to tell you. I'm not allowed to tell you." And I said, "Well, how can I help students in the situation if no one can tell me what I need in order to make sure that I can help them?" And I felt bad. And then I had a similar experience with a few other students that year. And I thought, this has got to change. So Brad says, "Well, you're going to have to change the law then." I said, "Okay, I will try to do that." And I knew I couldn't do it by myself. So I took it to the OEA Rep Assembly and said publicly to over 700 teachers in the room from all over the state, "I think this is an issue. I think this needs to be a legislative priority. What do you think?" And they voted with me. "Yes, we are concerned for the same reasons. We can't help these students. The safety and security of all students and helping all students be successful is in the heart and soul of every teacher in Oregon. And without the notices that we need in order to make sure that the learning environment is properly designed so that every student can be successful, we're not going to accomplish our goal, the state's goals, the No Child Left Behind, you name it. We can't do it unless we have information." At that rep assembly, after we had passed the resolution to have as a legislative priority, lots of people came up and talked to me about similar incidences in their own school. Several from the Salem-Keizer School District, which has a wonderful threat assessment program that I've seen that's phenomenal, based on John's presentation. But like with any other thing that you try to do, it's never perfect. And there were several people from Salem-Keizer that shared with me how bus drivers had been attacked and how staff members had been attacked from students in their building. But had they been told that a student had an anger issue or a student may act out violently, they would have never been in, put them in a situation where that might have happened. But again, they were forbidden from knowing. So everyone was really excited about that. So when 1092 passed, we were very happy. It has helped this year. The students, I haven't received official notification according to the guidelines of 1092. I've had parents and their families tell me that it's important that I know this information, and they've told me information about students. One committed a sex crime, and he very openly told me in a very quiet and private setting, and I was able to help him transition back into the school, provide support for him, make sure he's not in a situation where he's compromises himself. He's very happy. He's doing well. And since 1092 has passed, I haven't lost any kids that I've been given information about or that have provided me information. So we're figuring out a way to make it work. We're really happy with that part. I was also very pleased to be asked to participate in the Law Commission. It was an enlightening experience. A lot of paint dried. I think one of the high points was arguing over a period and a comma. But other than that, they were very passionate, well-educated, professional people, and I appreciated the detail to which they took the law seriously to make sure that it would work for people. A phenomenal group of people. I'm happy with most of the results. I'm concerned when the 10-to-1 law commission doesn't reflect the level of disagreement in our working group. There was a great deal of disagreement about many things, which is great. We have very passionate people. That's going to happen. I think at times they went beyond the scope of fixing the notification to trying to recraft the policy and limit the notification process. I hear the amendments are coming out. The amendments that I hear about, the -2 amendments, I support. I couldn't even believe that anyone would consider removing animal abuse, knowing what I've known about elementary teachers who have talked to me about having classroom animals and having those animals, not knowing that a student had been in that situation or had been accused of abusing animals and actually physically harmed an animal in front of the other classroom students and the trauma that caused. Anything that small, and mutilation, FFA animals at the high school level, I mean, there's things that we don't think about. We think, well, it's really not a school safety issue. Well, yeah, actually it is. Manufacture and distribution of substances, definitely an issue at the high school level. I would defer to Mr. Shreve to talk about that. He deals with that more than I do. And then I think the biggest thing that I was really concerned about was the conversation about the opt-in versus opt-out. And I remember distinctly Judge Horner saying, no, this is not the purview of the judge. I don't want anything to do with that. I'm not an expert on school safety. I don't want to be in a position to decide when to notify and when not. Err on the side of giving the information to schools, let them decide. They're the experts. They're the ones that spend all the time with the kids.
Ginger, I think we got the gist of...
Okay, so, difficult choices. Thank you for having this hearing. Thank you for asking the Law Commission. I appreciate their work.
I thank you for your stick-to-itiveness in following this through the origins. Did you want to add on to...
I would respond to Senator Bonamici. One of the comments. My name is Brad Shreve. I'm assistant principal, as Ginger mentioned, at Oregon City High School in charge of safety. And one of the correct questions was, in this time of information, you know, information abounding, why is this critical? That actually is one of the reasons that it's critical, because, for example, today we had all over Facebook and the school that one of our students had died. Well, fortunately, that was incorrect information that was being spread. We went to law enforcement and got some information about that. With respect to crimes, the same things tend to occur. And our clarification is, after things are adjudicated, we get a monthly probation list in the past. And so obviously that's part of why sort of the genesis of this and the concern around this. And the other thing is, you know, I was here partly to answer if you had any questions from that school administrator side of things. So
I just have a question.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to backtrack for just a minute about the story that Ginger told. And she said that when she said, why didn't you tell her, and you said it wasn't legal to tell. On what basis? So you knew about it, but you couldn't tell her? And
so I knew vague information about the student's history, about the fact that he had been on probation, and that was all, and it was a transfer student coming in new to us, and there was nothing in their school record or any direct information about their probation they had been under. I only knew about that student having been on probation because they mentioned on the intake interview they had been on probation in the past. So he actually incorrectly told Ginger some information in his classroom that he wasn't allowed because he was currently under he wasn't actually currently under probation. And so that information, all I had received information was he had been on probation, and I hadn't even heard that prior. So,
and you couldn't tell Ginger
so
that?
There wasn't any way of me identifying that. So it was a little bit of miscommunication between us, actually. But it was that I couldn't tell you what the nature of it was. I didn't even know was actually what occurred in that particular case. There have been cases. There were also cases where, for example, a student was being charged, and I couldn't tell during that time. I had heard, had heard about that, but that particular case actually was a little bit different.
And just a brief follow-up: on what basis can you not tell? What are you relying on this when
well,
you say you can't tell?
If there's an ongoing investigation or they're just being charged, then a lot of times I was instructed by either juvenile or the police, hey, you're not allowed to share any of this information if that's proceeding. And so previously, if I had information that there was a juvenile that was going to be adjudicated that was in process, then we didn't have any real information. It was just, I mean, they were accused of it, so I couldn't share anything.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger.
Well, thank you, Senator Bonamici, because I was wondering the same question. I still think we have a little gray area on that, and it's just when you said that, I couldn't understand that, and now it clarifies, not that you couldn't legally do it, you just didn't know what to say. Mm-hmm. But we also heard from Mr. Shetterly, if I'm incorrect, that if someone is in pre-adjudication and they've been charged, that is public record. So there's, I think part of it, like you say, is miscommunication. It's not that you couldn't share it. It's, part of the reason we did the bill last time and this one is to provide a clear conduit to make sure the information got to someone. But it wasn't so, if law enforcement had asked you not to say anything, it wasn't based, as I understand it, on law. It was just that, they had a preference for that. So I think your question was very good, Senator Bonamici, to make it clear that it wasn't the law that was in the way, it was a lack of communication, which is what we're trying to solve with both these pieces of legislation.
Yeah, because really that process that was discussed about Salem Kaiser using some information, you get some information, decide on a safety plan about a juvenile. One of the things is you won't start that safety plan if you don't get the information. We didn't have that sort of relationship where, as kids were being charged, we were receiving the information.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thank you all. Steve Dole.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United. I was thinking about it for a few minutes, and I realized that in the 14 years I've been coming to this building outside of the Judiciary Committees and the Public Safety Ways and Means and Rules, I've never been outside of those committees, so this is enjoyable. Thank you for your time.
You like our hearing room here?
I do. Very nice. Green's one of my favorite colors. I guess I would start by asking a somewhat rhetorical question. That is, why wouldn't we do this? I'm going to keep my testimony short in the interest of time, and also I don't want to be too repetitive about what's been said, but Mr. Harkleroad made the mention that knowledge is power. But in this case, I'd also say that knowledge is prevention. You know, sometimes in the system, particularly the juvenile system, we give a lot of lip service to preventing crime and to prevention, but we don't do real things on the ground. And I think this is one of those things that we can do on the ground. We are supportive of Senate Bill 512, but only with the Dash 2 amendments as drawn up by Mr. DiLorenzo and including those back in the bill. And that is for this reason. There has been many studies over the last 15 to 20 years about this issue of animal abuse. And let me quote you some high points of some of these studies. 70% of animal abuses had committed at least one other criminal offense. 40% of animal abusers had committed violent crimes against people. Animal abusers are 5 times more likely to commit a violent offense, 4 times more likely to commit a property offense, and 3 times more likely to be involved in drug offenses. I would have to tell you this on a personal note. I know this. I know this because my 12-year-old daughter, as most of you know, was a murder victim. And the 16-year-old youth who murdered her was an animal abuser. That was part of his juvenile record when they looked into it. The issue of assaults, misdemeanor assaults, I think because we tag that assault, fourth-degree assault, with the label misdemeanor, as Mr. Harkleroad indicated, and I think Ms. Wimmer also indicated, these can sometimes be very serious offenses. We're talking about people who've had their jaws broken and had to have them wired back together, who've had their eye sockets completely broken. These are serious offenses, and as Mr. Harkleroad says, because of the way the juvenile system works and because it's so much different from the adult system and the use of formal accountability agreements, believe me, the lesser offenses are weeded out and never brought to petition. And last but not least, this issue of the manufacture and distribution of drugs. There was a case a couple of years ago, and I think at least 3 of you, maybe all 4 of you on the committee were familiar with it, at Lincoln High School. The victim was a young man named Craig Crow. And Craig Crow unfortunately overdosed on cocaine. And he received that cocaine. It was distributed and manufactured through other high school students. So I would encourage you to consider the realities of these crimes. And again, think about the fact that in this case, knowledge can be prevention, and we'd ask you to include these crimes back in the bill. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Appreciate your testimony. Lori Satinspiel.
Chair Hass, Lori Satinspiel, the Oregon School Boards. In interest of time, I'm going to pass on to John Van Driel, Salem-Keizer School District, give you a sort of the district look at what's gone on. You've heard Salem-Keizer referenced a few times today, and we would just like to expand on some of those things, answer some questions about implementation maybe at the district level. So with that.
I appreciate that, John. Welcome, and we have your testimony here. Don't feel the need to read it all, but...
I will not. It is lengthy. I apologize. What I have is an abbreviated verbal version of that with some high points. I appreciate you allowing me to speak today. The first portion of that testimony basically is just a listing of what I do and have done for the last 10 years with threat assessment, violent youth. In the interest of time, of course, I'll only mention that that is a community collaboration that has many different agencies who serve youth involved with me in building and implementing a program that examines threats and the necessary steps needed to decrease the threat and a determination of who is to be notified. The reason I introduced this to you is to let you know that I do have a decade of experience with risk assessment and its application in the school setting. With that perspective, I want to first applaud your efforts to improve school safety through better notification procedures. I can only agree with the spirit of this law and its intentions to better inform warn and protect potential victim population. I've been working for this end for many years now. I also applaud the idea that if schools are better prepared and informed regarding the actions of offenders, they can take the appropriate precautions to reduce the chance of recidivistic offense and thus improve the offending youth's chances at a productive and pro-social life. I applaud both of those ideas. I cannot, however, support this bill as it is written, because I do not think that it will achieve either of those intentions. Merely notifying schools of alleged youth offenses that meet a particular danger criteria will not ensure a defensible procedure to conduct risk assessment or to determine who has a need to know. To receive, interpret, and further investigate that kind of notification can be complicated and time-consuming even for trained staff. In order to implement this bill, a school system will have to develop a standardized system by which to examine the context of the situation that exists around the alleged dangerous crime. That is because the information within the notice will not provide sufficient enough information to be able to determine a level of risk and to whom that risk is posed. It isn't that simple. Thus, to determine the risk and potential targets, a school administrator will have to make several follow-up inquiries for informing information regarding victim sets or targets, circumstantial information regarding ongoing intent, ideas to act out, or continue at-risk behavior in any current supervision or intervention information that is available. Again, a time-consuming effort. Certainly should be done if it can be done. However, this particular legislation will require that, and if those systems are not in place, systems similar to what I spoke of earlier, the outcome, I think, will be confusion. This is just the first part of an effective and defensible assessment of threat. Best practice recommendations also suggest that such an investigation as that be done through a multidisciplinary approach and not just through the discretion of one staff member who receives the information. As I said, the examination of context is important in that the criminal code and description of an alleged crime does not accurately indicate where the risk may be. For example, an assault three can mean a lot of things. First of all, the DA does not always determine a charge in a manner that clearly matches the police report or the indicated risk. I see this all the time. For example, one youth who has committed the physical act of the assault will get charged with the assault three. But so too will his two friends, bystanders who were encouraging him in the assault. So clearly, the charges and even the description of the crime does not necessarily provide the adequate information about target circumstances of the act, ongoing ideation or grudge, and vendetta issues. Such are the contextual features of future attacks. That's the information that schools need to know, not just a notice of the crime. Using a simple notice of criminal code language and description to accomplish adequate and accurate warning is roughly the equivalent of saying, after seeing me cough several times, hey, you have a cough. We're going to order up an MRI, some blood work, and maybe a few rounds of IV chemotherapy, along with partial quarantine and restrictions regarding your movement and who you can come in contact with or not. We're not sure. But somehow the local hospital administrator is going to figure this out. Regarding youth offenders, without contextual assessment, you'd have about the same chances of success by simply flipping a coin on every assault case to decide whether or not supervision, intervention, and further need-to-know warnings should be initiated. Obviously, in my example, if you're worried about the cough, you're going to want an established diagnostic system with measurement and examination protocols, along with, of course, funding to pay for those things. I see this bill, with all its good intentions, falling far short of creating a safer school environment. In fact, I think it will achieve the opposite, as it burdens and distracts administrators and does nothing to provide them with a system or a financial means of adequately attending to the increased number of notices, let alone the safety planning procedures that will be indicated for a small number of these notices. Furthermore, many of those notifications will be of little value in determining the kind of risk behavior the bill is attempting to identify and stop. I look at our local school district, Salem-Keizer, it's been referenced today, where we have an established system, though imperfect, of threat assessment in place, and yet this noticing rule will likely double or more the amount of time we spend tracking information down. Furthermore, the important aspects of that information are otherwise provided through established channels where it is actually appropriate to the school setting. Such established channels are proposed and provided for through the ORS numbers I've noted on your copy of my statement. As one who has spent 10 years in service to building and establishing safe school systems, I think that the architects of this bill have little idea of the time and energy it takes to provide the kind of process necessary to fairly and confidently examine the volume of notifications that will occur and the severity of those notifications. To make schools safer so students and teachers can learn and teach is a noble task. Again, I applaud that. However, attempting to do so with simple prescriptive legislation will be overreaching, ineffective, and frustrating to all involved. Ultimately, I think it will be a misuse of our increasingly limited resources. Finally, I'll return to the spirit of this bill. If adequate and appropriate notice is what you want to achieve through such a notice system, then you will need to fund the training and extra time to prepare school site teams to investigate and examine each offending use, circumstances, and situation so that they will know when to initiate threat assessment and appropriately inform those who are in a need-to-know position. This is not an expensive task, but it is a timely one that requires a sense of standardization and uniform application throughout the state. To pass this bill as written will further aggravate the inconsistencies in our schools, encourage overreactive measures by some schools, underreactive responses by others, and considerable mislabeling and misidentification of students. I have only to look at my own experience working with hundreds of administrators throughout my career to predict that this bill will, if implemented without a standardized and systemic protocol, lead to confusion. With this bill, administrators will differ in their responses. True, some will respond with appropriate supervision for all situations. However, most will likely respond either with overreaction, underreaction, or neglectful tolerance of all situations. If you pass this bill as it is, you must be prepared for school districts to be similarly inconsistent and thus lead to not safer schools, but more confused and tired school staff with possibly hyper-vigilant student body populations. I realize my testimony is an end-of-the-fourth-quarter Hail Mary pass here, but I cannot in good conscience not speak out against this. Thank you very much for taking the time to hear my thoughts. I do hope that as you consider this bill, you will be mindful of the concerns that I've raised.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to clarify something. You're testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 512 or Senate Bill 1092?
Well, yeah, I realize 1092 has passed. This is my attempt at addressing 512, but I would be similarly opposed to 1092.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair? So do you think that your remarks are still valid as it applies just to 512 going back to 1092? I'm a little confused.
I am too. I'm sorry about that. Like I said, this is a late effort on my part. I did not find out about 1092 till it had passed. I did have the opportunity to sit on the committee that reviewed it, and of course, knowledge that it was a passed bill. What I'm opposing, I guess, then is Senate Bill 512 as it's written.
I would just have a couple comments, Mr. Vandero. You used the word warnings here that the bill isn't. The idea isn't to warn anybody, it's just to provide notice. And your example here with the assault where there were bystanders who encouraged and watched.
Yes.
And that perhaps they shouldn't be. But
No, I didn't say they shouldn't. I would say that the assault three allegation, the crime that the school would receive notice about would be on all three of the students. Have much different situations.
Yeah, but if I'm a teacher, I think that's part of the point here, is that that is information that is valid for them to know.
Agreed.
Part of this.
That's why I applaud the information and the noticing aspects of this. What I don't applaud is the system that it goes into that doesn't exist in most districts. So I think you're leaving to the discretion and the lack of training this information to many educators that don't understand contextual threat. We heard earlier a gentleman speak to the need for educators to know who is capable of harm or serious injury at that discussion of creating a place at which you differentiate All these kids are capable of harm and serious and lethal injury. Everyone in this room is capable of such an act if given the correct motivation and circumstances. You have only to think of protecting your own family, and you can imagine what you or what you wouldn't do, which is very little, to protect them. The point of assessment is to figure out what those motivations and contexts are that would indicate the capacity to act out in a classroom. Dropping information such as this just into any school without a system in place to review that, I think will cause more harm and more disorganization than currently exists with our system as it stands.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you for your patience, committee. We have one last witness, I think, if he's still here, Brian Baker. Sorry to drop you on the last line, but we saved the best for last.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Brian Baker. I'm a juvenile court practitioner with the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. I've been a juvenile court attorney for 15 years representing kids in the dependency system and the delinquency system. I've also focused my practice for the last decade on educational advocacy for children in both systems. So I actually have a lot of experience on the ground of entering into school buildings to work with school teams around safety planning. And I pause for a moment after Mr. Van Driel's testimony, because I agree that Senate Bill 512 is but the beginning of the process, the notice to the school, and once that information is received, what the school does with that information. I think as a member of the work group addressing Senate Bill 1092 over the last few months, we grappled with creating a system to provide notice in the most important circumstances to schools, but also to not overwhelm schools with notices to the degree that the process would become ineffectual. One of the juvenile departments did a presentation to our work group trying to define the list of offenses that might generate notices under harm or threatened harm under the current language of Senate Bill 1092. It was literally an 8-page document with hundreds of offenses. The narrowing of the offense list was our attempt to address those most serious offenses, to recognize that within school buildings there are limited resources, limited counseling resources or school psychologist resources, that safety planning really is a multi-systems process that involves not only school personnel but also juvenile court practitioners, juvenile department representation, district attorneys, the courts, to really have a meaningful process. And as I mentioned to the committee, that is a process that I've been engaged in many a time, where we sit down at a table and talk about what are this young person's needs in order to be here in the building, for him or her to be safe, for staff and for other students to be safe. Can we meet that child's needs here? Do we need to look at alternative placements? All of those kinds of issues. I think I often thought within the work group discussions also, it was difficult for the non-juvenile court practitioners to have a full understanding of the juvenile court side and the decision-making that occurs with the juvenile court judge. Our county is different than Lane County. We actually have petitions issued on many, many low-level offenses, including assault, fours, and harassments. Harassment is offensive physical contact. So Johnny pushes Jimmy, that can be charged as an harassment. We grappled with trying not to, again, overwhelm schools with off-campus behavior that was at a level that really didn't implicate school safety or student or staff safety. There are many assault fours that are low level, where someone a bruise results or a split lip results, that could be charged as an assault four. I would say I disagree with prior testimony in the example of the eye socket or the nose. Serious physical injury is protracted injury. I believe those could be charged at the felony level, and that those would kick in the automatic notice. But I also come back to the compromise that was reached within the work group to address the opt-in, the safety valve. And apologize to the committee that we have opt-in, the confusion around that. Believe me, we were often confused about that. But the safety valve really was a very lengthy discussion around having essentially having a catch-all that would allow the parties to the juvenile court case to say, in this circumstance, because it's just charged as an assault four or harassment or something not on the enumerated list, but there are factors here present in reviewing the police reports and the information that's come in that suggests to us that there is risk within the school, notice can go out. Our juvenile code mandates two courts at preliminary hearings, at first appearances, to address community safety. The judges are responsible, the judges and referees are responsible to make a decision about whether or not a child pre-adjudication, so pre-trial, should be out in the community or should be in detention. And potentially, one of the factors that the court is looking at are the protective factors within the community, supervision by the family, is the child involved in community-based services, mental health, that type of thing, as well as the protective factors of school attendance and being regularly at school. So there is an extensive process and a meaningful process that occurs when a child, when a youth comes before the court and a decision's made about release back out to the community. As Mr. Van Driel said, meaningful risk assessment and safety planning is a process that takes time, that takes that it's a multi-systemic, multidisciplinary approach. And as an attorney within the juvenile court system, I stay with that case throughout the process, and there is quite a bit of evaluation that occurs, psychological evaluations, mental health assessments, that address the needs of that child, the service needs, the safety needs to both the child and to others, but that takes time. And again, I want the committee to be aware that we really struggled with creating a process, a notice process, particularly in these pre-adjudicatory stage, which is the early in the stage when we don't necessarily have a lot of information, to not create a process that would be so overwhelming to the receiving district that it would just become meaningless. And we had a basis to have that concern when we learned that existing notice requirements for children that had been adjudicated on probation and so forth, that it was pretty It became more apparent to us that there were it was hit or miss as to whether or not those notices were regularly generating, whether or not that information was being received. We don't want to create another element to the notice process that really won't result in any meaningful planning. Again, I have to emphasize that I think we narrowed the list of offenses to address the most serious offenses. We added a safety valve for any other moment in time or offense that folks feel there could be risk within the school district to allow for that notice. We feel that this will hopefully be more workable in the sense that we recognize in these tight budgetary times that there will not be in the foreseeable future new and additional resources moving to schools to provide that additional counseling staff or school psychologist staff. I reviewed Attorney General Hardy Meyer's report after the Kip Kinkle incident, and one of the findings within that report in 1999 was that districts were struggling to have appropriate training opportunities, resources to respond to safety planning. That's been an issue. That's an issue that emerged after that incident. I think what I also have to say to the committee is I reviewed our data within Multnomah County. I'm a practitioner in Multnomah County. I'm pleased to say that our latest data from 2007, we had a 5% decrease in juvenile justice referrals in 2007. I'm pleased to say to the committee that 4 out of 5 of those young people referred to the juvenile court system are handled pre-adjudication, meaning that they are able to and amenable to community-based interventions, whether that's formal accountability agreement, other forms of diversion. But the juvenile court system is designed to focus services on children and families. The juvenile justice side of it to put in proactive safety planning to access those community-based services, and that's happening successfully. those children that move on to formal adjudication actually are found in the jurisdiction and placed on probation. Of course, at each stage of the process, additional services come on board. Some of those children will need to be in out-of-home placements, residential treatment, youth corrections facilities, but I'm pleased to say that that's a pretty small percentage when you look at the large number of children within the system. The other, and I'll leave with this. The other concern that I have, again, as a court practitioner and working with youth, I did an informal study in 1999 amongst our juvenile department probationers, and in Multnomah County at that time, 50% of our probationers, so children who were not in facilities, who were on probation, were out of school. Every one of those youth were required to be in school, were court mandated to be in school, but for many various reasons were not in school. I do worry about school exclusion, and I do see school as a protective factor for children, both pre- and post-adjudication, who are in the community. They need to be in school. They need to have school success. If I could take any questions.
Sure. Questions for Mr. Baker. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just want to make sure I understand something you said about how there's a time for the judges to address community safety pre-adjudication. Because what I'm trying to figure out is how that determination would be made in that new language, this catch-all, and just procedurally, how would that work?
Okay. Chair Haas and Senator Bonamici, the opt-in, and I apologize, I have written testimony that I just only now gave to the committee. The opt-in provision envisions that at that first appearance, what we in Multnomah County call the preliminary hearing, when the court is making a determination about probable cause for a charge for a petition to issue, a determination about whether or not that child needs to be detained potentially pre-adjudication, addressing those community safety factors, addressing protective safety factors, making a decision about pretrial release or not, whether the child will return to court, for example. That's where that would be inserted. In that global discussion, there would be a determination, again, based on the facts that are presented at that hearing, whether or not there's potential risk within the school community. I don't want to say absolutely that in every circumstance, as a defense attorney, I would be disputing that in a particular instance notice not go out, because it might actually be in my client's interest in making an argument for pretrial release to engage in active safety planning at the school building in order to ensure success in that pre-adjudicatory release status. So it's unfair to characterize that in every instance the defense would object to notice going out. I think these would be decisions that would occur case by case, and that was the idea within the work group, was let's look at these instances that are not on the mandatory list on a case-by-case basis and really address those that potentially bring up risk factors. We mentioned within the work group that there could be a low-level assault for harassment that involved gang activity. And this is activity off of campus, and but might involve other students or other schools or those kinds of things. And that absolutely could be an instance where there would be a discussion about notice ought to generate here so that school folks are aware of who all the children were that were involved, and to monitor campus and those kinds of things. So I really do believe that safety valve captures a careful examination, a careful process that would look case by case at the individual needs. It was mentioned that Judge Horner was struggling with the issue of making determinations about school safety. Well, the court is not alone. The first appearance, there's juvenile department, there's defense, there's prosecution, family members. Those hearings are open. Potentially, there's no reason why school staff and others couldn't come into those hearings to provide information to the court. And the court is the recipient of all that information to do planning about the needs of this particular youth. But the court is tasked under the juvenile code, under current or Oregon revised statutes, to make determinations about pre-trial detention and community-based risk and safety. And that, of course, includes safety within the school community, as well as the community at large.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Brian, for giving us that background, and we appreciate your experience in these issues.
Thank you, Clint. Thank you.
Committee, thank you for your patience. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 512, and we are adjourned.